Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. I'm joined today by one of America's most acclaimed storytellers. She has a fascinating story because her very first book was chosen as Oprah's very first book club selection. What are the chances of that happening? But obviously she went on to great things after that and has had running success. She's a number one New York Times bestselling author of 12 novels for adults, 7 novels for teenagers, and 5 children's books. She was a former daily newspaper reporter and a professor in the Master of Fine Arts program at Miami University of Ohio. She also writes for publications such as Glamour, Oprah, Winfrey Magazine, and Marie Claire and Reader's Digest. And Jacqueline Michard is who I'm talking about, of course. Her new book is called The Good Son. And Jacqueline was actually standing in a coffee line when the inspiration for this story came together. And we talk about that too in our conversation today. So let me bring on my guest, Jacqueline Michard, and her new book, The Good Son. Jacqueline Michard, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. We haven't talked before. The book we're talking about today is your latest novel, The Good Son. Let's begin with a little background, since we haven't chatted before. I read that you had the honor of being Oprah's first guest author for her book club with The Deep End of the Ocean. I'm guessing since it was the very first time she had a book club and she was introducing it, you didn't really know what to expect from that, right?
Even more so, my publisher did not know what to expect and really told me to dial down my expectations, because they pointed out that television, people who watch daytime television and people who read books, those are antithetical. And so that I shouldn't, this was all well and good, and the idea of starting the world's largest book club was a clever idea and so forth, but that I shouldn't expect there to be a huge reaction to it. But by the evening of the day that the book was first introduced on that show, there were 4,000 holds on it at the New York Public Library.
Amazing. And this was your very first novel, right?
Indeed. Yes, the little book that could.
I read that you were a young widow, 3 little kids, no life insurance. Life wasn't being good to you. And that's why you wrote this novel, to prove there was going to be a second act for us. We're talking about The Deep End of the Ocean, your first novel.
That's absolutely true. I wanted to prove to myself, if I could, that there would be life after death, not my death, but my husband's. And our lives had sort of fallen down around our ears in quite a literal way. And I wanted the kids, especially, and myself, to believe that having a tragedy that felt like a train being driven over you did not also confer on you the permission to live a small life. Mm. I wanted to try something that I had not written any fiction since the freshman elective at the University of Illinois. And I wanted to try to do something impossible.
Right. I'm wondering where you found that strength to do this something impossible, which turned out really great for you, because under those circumstances, so many people would say, you know, they'd use those situations as an excuse not to.
That's exactly what I was terrified of. I was terrified that I wouldn't take any more risks, and I was terrified that I wouldn't try anything more with my life on the back 40. You know, I was in my late 30s, and I thought I wouldn't. There was a real impulse to retreat, and I was really frightened about that because I had been throughout my life. If not, I mean, I'm not silly this way, but I try to be optimistic. And I had tried throughout my life to be optimistic and think that things might work out. And this had been this period, losing my husband so young and in such a horrible way as his death, as he died, was a resonant lesson in the opposite, that things sometimes were not going to work out and they weren't going to work out with a vengeance. So I wanted to try, if I could, to militate against that. And I would have considered it a worthwhile exercise even if the book had only gotten published and not become such a thing as it did. By the end of writing it, I knew that it would get published. I knew it was good enough to get published, but I didn't expect it would turn out the way it did.
Yeah, number one bestseller, and what this is, The Good Son we're talking about today, is what, your 22nd novel?
Yes.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I read in the acknowledgments of The Good Son that this story was inspired by a real-life encounter when you were grabbing coffee at a convention. The woman in the coffee line in front of you dropped her book. Tell us what happened and how it led to inspiring this story.
And when I handed it back to her, I picked it up and handed it back to her, and I asked her, because she was carrying a book, it was a natural assumption that she was there for this writer's conference. And I asked her if she was, and she said no. She came every weekend to this hotel to stay because she was visiting her son, who was in prison nearby, and he was only 19, and he would be in prison for a very long time. And I kept thinking in my mind, I kept thinking, oh, please, please, please don't tell me what he's in prison for, but if she did, he had murdered his beloved, the only girl he ever loved, his girlfriend since the seventh grade, and he was so messed up on methamphetamines at the time that he had no memory of the night at all, and he would be in prison for a very long time. And she also told me a scene that in a different way shows up in the novel, The Good Son, that she had gone to the cemetery to put roses on the girl's grave, and the girl's mother showed up, and the woman was terrified and thought, what will happen? And they ended up crying in each other's arms, and the mother of the girl said, at least you can still touch him.
Very, very moving story. And so I guess that kind of sat with you for a little while. It's the kind of story that would. But then how did you, I know you didn't really want to write about it to begin with because, you know, story, not that story, but the story that was swirling in your head because it was, you know, a story of anguish. So at what point did things really start to come together and you felt, I have to tell this story? The story took over, if you will.
Well, I had tried to write two other books, and unprecedented in my writing life, neither of those took shape. They sort of just lay on the page and would not come together. They wouldn't gel. And this story had been in my mind for years by that point. And when I told my agent about it, he said, that's all very interesting, but you really can't make these characters sympathetic. And I was shocked because to me they already were sympathetic.
Yeah.
I mean, by the nature of their anguish and their grief, they already were deserving of, if not liking, then at least compassion. And I remembered having written The Deep End of the Ocean and how very few people really liked the character of Beth Cappadora, the mother whose little boy was kidnapped in the story. And because she was depressed and she was distant and she was harsh and angry in the way that people who have been through a tragedy can be, she didn't become a light of mercy and compassion necessarily. She was she boiled in her own pain, and yet I loved her, and I felt that she was worthy of my story. And at the end of the day, in that book, and also in The Good Son, though they're not at all comparable, the grieving mother is the one who does the right thing, or one of the grieving mothers anyway does the thing that needs to be done.
And I think if a character has done bad things, you know, that a lot of people would condone, if you will, if you can relate to how they're feeling on some level, that there's your sympathy, right?
I guess so. Sometimes people call it the, and I didn't know this term until just recently, but it's terrific, the Godfather effect. Because when you watch the movie The Godfather, which there are probably two people listening to you right now who haven't seen that movie, because everyone's seen that movie, that those people are, they're killers, and you know, and one of them, one of the Corleone brothers, is a psychopath, if you will. And yet, somehow, the viewer, the story is so skillfully made that somehow the viewer feels understanding and even a certain measure of identification with that family.
Right, right. And the driving theme for you in the concept, really, I would guess, and I've read this, I think on your website maybe, is could you still love the one you loved most in the world after he'd done something so awful? You're a mom yourself. You've got, what, five sons and nine kids total, right?
Yep.
So I'm sure that's a question that you pictured yourself. Personally, I mean, I don't have kids, but I can see that even if your child has done something really bad, there would be the part of you that still sees that grown up, if you will, as a little hurt kid. And there must be really conflicting feelings there. I'm sure you went through that in your own mind as you're developing this, right?
I did indeed. And also I had watched a TED Talk given by Sue Klebold, whose son Dylan Klebold was one of the school shooters at Columbine many years ago. And I knew that there were people in the audience who, when she explained that, of course, she still loved her boy, were absolutely blown back by that. Hmm. How could you still love someone who was a monster? But she was talking not just about, and I think she still loved her boy who had killed people and who had committed suicide as well, but also the child who was caged inside of him that she had raised and believed that, and still believed, that she had done everything she could do to be a good mother, not done anything different from the things her friends had done.
Right, right. So we've kind of touched on some of the themes in the book here, but I wonder if you'd just give a short synopsis for listeners. I don't like to do that myself. I never like to give away spoilers. So if they're going to happen, the author's going to do it.
Okay. Well, it begins and also ends, but that's a whole other story. At the gates of a prison, in Stefan, who is Thea's son, is coming out of prison after having served time for his role in the death of Belinda, the girl he loved. And she has the task of trying to help him to face a community that is lined up against him, in part because of the efforts of Belinda's mother to create more awareness of dating violence and how that's a sort of unseen piece of the domestic violence puzzle and to raise awareness about that as he comes out of prison. And also there are people who are actively threatening Stefan, both in a sort of secret way, calling him and texting her, and threatening his very life, his welfare. And so she feels embattled and then realizes that she has kept herself from knowing the full story about what happened on that night and what happened with Belinda on that night, because she has never wanted to revisit that catastrophe that changed all their lives forever. And as she starts to do that, she begins to realize that nobody truly understands or even knows what happened that night.
Right.
And her journey is toward that.
Right. So Belinda is the murdered girlfriend of Stefan, and she is talked about, obviously, throughout the story, but she's never alive in the story. When you're developing a character like that, what kind of thoughts go through your head to flesh her out? Because we do have a tendency, I think, you know, I'm a huge fan of things like 48 Hours and true crime investigations. And often when somebody's died tragically, when they've been murdered, for example, we tend to memorialize them and everybody says the most wonderful things about them. But you created a very real character in Belinda, even though she never really appeared in it alive.
I really tried to do that. I didn't want her to be some idealized angelic creature. Everyone had a different memory of Belinda, the boy who loved her, her mother, the girl who loved her, and also Thea, who once thought Belinda might be her daughter-in-law someday because the love between them was so real. And yet Belinda, through the accounts of everyone who knew her, emerges as this girl who really wanted to find out who she was, and she was exuberant, and she was trying out many things in her life, some of which were dangerous to her, and some of which were not the kinds of things that her deeply religious mother and her grandfather, who was a minister, would have wanted for her. She was a girl who was filled with life and curiosity, and to me that made her death almost even more tragic than if she had been passive and this little flower, because she was determined to know everything and try to be everything. And in the process of that, what sparked Stefan's jealousy was that he felt that she would outstrip him and slip away from him.
I've heard, you know, a lot. I've interviewed so many authors over the years, and many have spoken, I've spoken with, say their characters speak to them. Their characters tell them what to write, where the story's going. Someone asked you on an interview I watched, a presentation I watched, if your characters speak to you, and you said, it made me laugh out loud, my characters would sit on a couch and eat Doritos if I didn't make them do something. So you keep them on a very short leash. So when you're starting to flesh out these characters, and, you know, Thea, for example, the mother of Stefan, obviously she loves him, but it's like, do I still love him after this? How did you work with that and her character?
I try to imagine, Thea describes herself as someone who had no reason to expect anything from her upbringing or her education or her marriage except a moderately good life. She didn't believe that she was ever going to be a superstar in anything. She was an English professor. She would. She believed that she would have really, as she puts it, really great hair, because she really had pretty hair, and a moderately good life in other ways. And she had not been really disappointed in that until the night Belinda died and her life blew up. Mm-hmm. And so everything that she had come to expect in her life blew up in her face, and suddenly not just her community, but her own family and her colleagues were all turning against her and turning against her son, and she felt the eyes of suspicion on her. And in some ways, she wanted to fight back and say, look, I didn't do anything. It wasn't I who's responsible for this awful event. So why are all of you cutting me, turning against me? And so she was in a position of anguish and grief, but also in a position of anger at the people who had once been so close to her, now suddenly didn't want to know her anymore.
It definitely talks about the frailty of community, as well as, you know, there are several themes in the book. One of them, of course, is rehabilitation, returning home. I'm assuming you did research on what it's like for prisoners, what it's like for men who've been incarcerated to come home. Tell us a little bit about that.
I did that, and I also did research. I talked particularly with two women who had sons, young men, one of whom was much like Stefan in the sense that he was a tenderly raised kid who did not have the expectation that a criminal act would be a part of his life. The other woman I interviewed, she said herself that her son was a good son but not a good boy. And it seemed almost inevitable within his social framework that he would end up in trouble at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And because I wanted to see what the contrast was on the part of those kids coming back into the community. And it's the time in which a person is most vulnerable because there's an expectation that you have served your time and now you get a chance perhaps to start over. But the reality is that is the time often when people reoffend or when they take their own lives, because there is no acceptance. There is we are a culture in the United States, at least we say we are, that believes in second chances and comebacks and things like that. But it depends, I think, on the nature of the crime and on the nature of the community in terms of whether that can really come to pass. And it takes an extraordinary amount of perseverance and, if you will, character for someone to be able to stay on the straight and narrow.
Talking about, you know, he was not a good boy, but he's a good son. How did you come up with the title for The Good Son? I read that you always write your own titles for your books. Was that the case in this case?
No. I was against this title, though I'm used to it now, because it had been occupied in other ways by other works of film and fiction. And I really didn't want this title, though I can see the reason for it. I really can see the reason for it. But I had a different title. And if I had one title for this book, I had 25 titles for this book. Over and over and over, I would bring a title to the editor and to my agent. And finally, my agent and I agreed on one, and we brought it to the editor. And the editor said, no, I don't like that. And I was just so frustrated because it just didn't. I couldn't make it work. Now I'm used to it. Now I love the cover of the book, for example, its colors and its concept and so forth. And so I'm used to it. But it was by far not my first choice. And the only time that I've ever had to sort of given.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about writing, because you've made your living as a writer, as a reporter, novelist, an essayist, professor of creative nonfiction writing. Yet you wrote a blog post called Every Time. You said, you write about how hard it is to sit down and write, that writing is daunting, and even that you have a hard time saying, I'm an author. Tell us about that.
Well, I do have a hard time saying it. It seems to be something that's kind of grand, and I don't know if it's because I'm a woman. Sometimes I think that's part of it, or because it's just so difficult for me. I am not a natural. I am not a novelist who has enormous confidence, and who, like so many of my friends, say that they're just taking dictation from the universe and the story writes itself. I sweat blood every single sentence, and I can't go on to the next sentence until I fix the one before, and then I think they're all horrible and I just want to get a funny hat and a funny nose and move somewhere else and change my name, because I just think that I'm not cut out for this. And then at a certain point, I sort of find the thread of the story and pull myself along, but it's never easy, and it's never joyous.
Interesting, because, you know, I'm a creative nonfiction writer, and I do a lot of commercial work, too. And there are times when I would rather do anything than sit down and write.
Anything.
Yeah. Like, I would rather get down on my knees and scrub my bathroom floor with a toothbrush than sit in my chair and write sometimes.
Absolutely. And yet I just wrote a blog post or for a newsletter that I have started to do about my terror of procrastination. I'm terrified of procrastinating and doing just that, putting it off, because I think that I'll end up somehow as someone who is sitting metaphorically at the end of the bar and saying, well, yeah, you know, I'm a writer. I'm afraid of being that person who is a sort of a hack and yet still talking about her glory days. But so I make myself do it. I make myself do it to the overcoming all the terrified voices in my head and the lure my characters who just want to pop open that beer and have those Doritos.
I want to ask you about Ray Bradbury, because I've read that he was your mentor, of course, the author of many books himself, Fahrenheit 451, and one of my favorite books on writing. He wrote Zen in the Art of Writing. How was he a mentor to you? How did he inspire and influence you?
It is actually a lovely story that I'll tell you briefly. When I was a young reporter, if you will, I was reading, my husband, who was older than I, had a daughter from a previous marriage, and she was still kind of little, 6 or 7, and I was reading the story to her, I Sing the Body Electric, which the movie The Robot Grandmother was made from that, and I can't even talk about it without starting to cry, because it's just in the quintessential Ray Bradbury story in which everything is strange and quirky, and then all of a sudden it's so deeply poignant that it tears your heart apart. So I wrote him a fan letter, one of only 2 fan letters I've ever written in my entire life, and the other one was to Tom Petty. When I was widowed, I wrote to Tom Petty and said, would you marry me? That was the other one. I wrote to Ray Bradbury and told him what this story had meant to me, what his writing had meant to me. And one day I was sitting in the newsroom. I forgot about it, okay? And someone brought me a big envelope. And it was a big manila envelope drawn all over with beautifully drawn and colored pictures of vampires and creatures with great leathery green wings and signs in old graveyards. And on it, just like sort of in the play Our Town, it said to Jacqueline Machard, a very good writer indeed, Madison, Wisconsin. That was all it said, and it still got to me.
Wow.
It was a letter from Ray, also illustrated, beautifully illustrated, and I want to have this framed for my daughter-in-law, who is a great fan of his. I wrote back to him. We corresponded for years. Whenever I would go to Los Angeles, we would have dinner. He was enormously encouraging about my writing, though it was entirely different from the writing that he did. And I remember corresponding with him right before he died. He was still very actively, at the age of like 92 or 94, still very actively involved in the plans for his writing. He wanted to have a movie filmed of his novel about the vampires who have a human child. That is their tragedy, called The Homecoming.
Mm-hmm.
And we were writing back and forth about that when he finally did die. He was very generous.
I've heard that. I've read several stories where he's been very generous. It's nice to speak to somebody who actually experienced that and, put a name to it. So I want to just very quickly ask you a couple of words that I took from the themes that ran through your book. One of them is resilience. When you hear the word resilience, what instantly pops to mind for you?
What instantly pops to mind for me is the absolutely astonishing power of love. Because love, it really does, as it says in the Bible, weather all things and believe all things and endure all things. And to me, that is one of the predominant themes in The Good Son, is that love bears all and somehow manages to remain intact in the most unimaginable circumstances.
I love that. And the other theme, of course, that runs through the book is courage. And you've certainly you must have a lot of courage because of the things you've gone through in your own life. So tell us what courage means to you.
Well, courage to me means resilience. It's funny that those two things are really linked.
Yeah.
To be like that doll I had as a child, and probably you did too, the blow-up rubber thing that you would knock it down and it would stand back up again, and you would knock it down and it would stand back up again. But at the end of the day, I don't know whether that's really courage, because if you're in a dark circumstance, courage requires options, as a great friend of mine who's a wonderful writer once said. And in some of the things that I've been through in my life that I've come back from, I didn't have any option. I mean, the only way out was to go through it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other option was to sit in the closet and chew on my raincoat.
Right.
And so I felt that I didn't have a choice. I'm glad I didn't have a choice, but it isn't necessarily, I guess that courage is something you look back on and realize you had.
Yeah. Well, it's been such a treat talking with you, Jacqueline Machard. The book is called The Good Son. I know listeners can find out much more about you at your website, read your blog posts, all about your work, JacquelineMachard.com. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Have courage.
There we go. I love it. Yes.
It will never be unrewarded, even if you're the only one who knows about it.
Love it. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Jacqueline. I hope we'll get a chance to talk again sometime.
Thank you so much.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.